Robinson Crusoe is a novel by Daniel Defoe, published in 1719. Epistolary, confessional, and didactic in form, the book is presented as an autobiography of the title character, who is a castaway spending 28 years on a remote tropical desert island near the coasts of Venezuela and Trinidad, and encountering cannibals, captives, and mutineers before being rescued. The story has been thought to be based on the life of Alexander Selkirk, a Scottish castaway who lived for 4 years on a Pacific island called Masa Tierra, now part of Chile. In 1966, the island was thereafter renamed Robinson Crusoe Island. Robinson Crusoe was well received in the literary world and is often credited as marking the beginning of realistic fiction as a literary genre. It is generally seen as a contender for the first English novel. Before the end of 1719, the book had already run through 4 editions and it has gone on to become one of the most widely published books in history, spawning so many imitations, not only in literature, but also in film, television, and radio. So much so that its name is used to define a genre called the Robinsonade. According to critics, Robinson is actually viewed not as a hero, but an everyman. He begins as a wanderer, aimless on a sea that he does not understand, and ends as a pilgrim, crossing a final mountain to enter the promised land. The work has been variously read as an allegory for the development of civilization, as a manifesto of economic individualism, and as an expression of European colonial desires. Thank you for tuning in to The Global Novel. I'm Claire Hennessy. Joining me today are Dr. Jakub Lipsky, Dr. Glynis Ridley, and Dr. Andreas Mueller. Dr. Jakub Lipsky is an associate professor of English at Kazimierz Wielki University in Bydgoszcz, Poland. He's the author of In Quest of Self, Masquerade and Travel in the 18th Century Novel, and Painting the Novel, Pictorial Discourse in 18th Century English Fiction. Dr. Glynis Ridley is the author of Clara's Grand Tour, Travels with a Rhinoceros in 18th Century Europe, which was the winner of Institute of Historical Research Prize. She is professor of English at the University of Louisville. Dr. Andreas Mueller is professor and chair of English at Metropolitan State University of Denver. He is the author of A Critical Study of Daniel Defoe's Verse and editor of Daniel Defoe's Nonfiction, Form, Function, Genre. He has published several essays on Defoe. Welcome to the show, everybody. So, Andreas, the novel was well received upon its publication, establishing Defoe as an accomplished writer almost immediately. So, what do you think makes the novel an instant appeal?
Well, I think in 1719, the novel became instantly popular because Defoe was basically hooking into an established market for this kind of writing. You know, travel writing had been around for some time and it had sold well, and I'm pretty sure that Defoe's motivation, among various other things, for writing this was also to make some money, because you could be almost certain that it would shift enough copies to pay, you know, a few pounds, I suppose, for this. So, you know, the idea behind that really is that it is, to some extent, a potential crowd pleaser when you write this sort of thing. And it was. And of course, people like, you know, Jonathan Swift mocked travel writing like this in Gulliver's Travels, right? And that its popularity. So there's that, and I think one thing always to kind of point out about this as well is that it was certainly considered to be lowbrow writing, hence Swift's satire, and what various other people at the time had to say about Crusoe's popularity. There was jealousy around how popular it was and how many copies it shifted. I think you mentioned earlier that it went to 4 editions within the first year of its publication, right? And I think, if I remember rightly, a print run was around 1,000 copies, you know, so 4,000 copies in the first year. Doesn't sound a lot to us, but was certainly quite a lot at the time, and certainly for this kind of prose fiction. And I also think the, you know, the whole adventure impulse behind it, and, you know, the British colonial effort quite possibly also inspired readers to really like this book and talk about it.
Right. Well, Defoe created a genre in its own time, what nowadays is called the Robinsonade. So, Glynis, could you briefly explain to our listeners what the Robinsonade is and what it contains?
Yes, I think listeners will be familiar with examples of the Robinsonade, even if they haven't encountered that term before. Basically, a Robinsonade is any narrative in which an individual, or sometimes a small group, is forced to test their survival skills in an isolated setting. I should say straight away that while Crusoe's shipwreck and life on an island is by no means the entirety of Defoe's first novel about Crusoe, it's this combination of isolation and the attempt to survive that's the essence of the Robinson art. So within a decade of the first appearance of Robinson Crusoe in 1719, you have novels such as Peter Longville's The Hermit from 1727, in which a protagonist learns to live on an island off the coast of Mexico. Obviously, the island setting is derivative of Defoe's texts. Listeners might be aware of other imitations, such as the hugely successful Swiss Family Robinson from 1812. But today, we needn't confine ourselves to novels when we're thinking about examples of the Robinson art. Some listeners will have seen the 2000 Robert Zemeckis movie, Castaway, starring Tom Hanks as a FedEx executive who's stranded on an island. I remember a grisly scene from that movie in which Tom Hanks's character has to engage in some DIY dentistry, and it sort of perfectly exemplifies the way in which the Robinson art faces with the question, what would we do in such circumstances? Could we survive? And finally, I learned that the History Channel here in the US has a reality TV survival show called Alone, in which contestants try to survive in the wilderness, competing for a cash prize. The format's apparently been sold to TV companies in Australia and in Europe. And I think it's a perfect and perfectly up-to-date example of the Robinson art and how it can now encompass reality TV as well as 18th century novels.
That is quite interesting. Well, Yaqub, what do you think the genre of Robinsonade reveals to us? Why is it such an enduring form? And why are creators and receivers of Robinsonade texts still drawn to it?
The endurance and attractiveness of the Robinsonade as a form is, of course, a logical, one could say, consequence of the phenomenal success of Robinson Crusoe, both in its original context and beyond. I have also asked myself the question about the origins of the Crusoe phenomenon. And while this can't be the only answer, I think they can be located in a unique mixture of the universal and the particular. The Crusoe story combines several mythical patterns that are central to our collective imagination. The hero's journey, the myth of origins, the foundational myth, the myth of redemption, and more. At the same time, Robinson Crusoe was a product of its own context, with its explicit religious and political messages. The same holds true about the Robinsonade. It continues to reenact the familiar myths while being responsive to whatever is topical and relevant at a given moment. We agree that the Robinsonade first developed as a form strongly supportive of the imperial cause, but if we think about Robinsonades in the 20th and 21st centuries, the form seems to have been particularly useful for progressive messages, engaging with post-colonial, feminist, and today especially eco-critical and post-humanist concerns. This is a major redefinition of its purposes, testimony to the fluidity and continuous adaptability of the Robinsonade.
Right. So, Andreas, in your essay, you mainly discussed how the name Robinson Crusoe, which is the linguistic sign, has assumed iconic status in modern Western culture. So could you first share more on Robinson Crusoe as a myth? We know that Ian Watt studied Defoe in detail and at one point claimed that Defoe's narrative hardly supports some of the symbolic uses to which the Crusoe myth has been put, adding by way of explanation that a defining feature of myth is that they're shaped by the unconscious needs of the society that invokes them, at least as much as the context of the original story. So what do you think Ian Watt aims to convey here?
Actually, before I answer that question, and Ian Watt had a bunch of very good things to say about Robinson Crusoe as myth, let me just tell you how my own idea for the chapter that I wrote came about. I was traveling from England to the US, and when you get to border control, you're inevitably asked why you're coming in. This is before I moved here full time. And the Homeland Security officer wanted to know why I was going to a certain conference and what I was going to do there. And I said, well, I'm going to go to this conference. It was a Defoe Society conference, and I'm going to present a paper on Daniel Defoe, you know, surprise. And he had no idea who Daniel Defoe was, right? So I said, Robinson Crusoe. And he went, ah, okay, I'm going to let you in. Right? and it was clear that he'd never read Robinson Crusoe. You know, there was no point in even starting a conversation, not that they ever do that at the border. And I thought, that's interesting that people recognize the name in complete isolation, right? And that was kind of the point of origin for the essay that I wrote ultimately. And I think there's still a distinction to be made between myth and icon, right? They're connected at a certain level, but they're a slightly different thing. And Jakub touched on this already in terms of the mythical aspect of the story that, you know, Defoe gives us. Where I think Ian Watt gets it exactly right is when he points out that myths tend to be whittled down to some very essential parts. So he calls them a single significant situation in the story, which then can also develop their own life, if you like, you know, detached from the story. So what people then do with that actually has either very little to do with the original story or maybe even nothing at all. And I took that as a starting point for the research that I did for the paper by looking at some examples of how the name Robinson Crusoe had been used more recently, because Watt wrote his that particular article in the 1950s, so 70 years ago, and things have to some extent changed again, but not entirely. So I was selective, of course. I had to be selective because the name Crusoe is actually out there in all sorts of different contexts, right? And what I found was, firstly, that Watt was right on that folks use the name in a way that's kind of emptied it as a signifier, right? It doesn't really represent the story, not closely anymore, but in some ways not at all. But there's some kind of residual element there that does still link it to the story, right? Even though the people who are using the name, often for commercial purposes, don't fully realize what they're doing with it. I think this is kind of the cultural undercurrent of how this has been transmitted over three centuries plus by now, right? The reasons for that are actually what Galinus and Jakub have already mentioned, you know, the adventure story that essentially returns to survival, human survival, human resilience and ingenuity in a hostile environment, and how this individual, isolated from all other humans, actually copes with that psychologically, but also practically, right? And there seems to me an ongoing fascination with that kind of story, and Crusoe's become emblematic for that kind of story, right? And the other thing that seems to have taken away and been attached to the name, but not really necessarily because of the knowledge of the story, most people haven't read Robinson Crusoe, right? They've come across it somewhere in some variation, but they haven't read the original story. It's this idea of isolation. And it's become iconic for that, but in a different way, in a sense, from what the story tells us. And a good example for that is the travel company Robinson Club, for example, which offers upmarket holidays in quiet, almost isolated, very pleasant kind of exotic spots, you know, white sandy beaches, clear water kind of stuff, where you can go and switch off and be deliberately removed from your everyday life and everyday civilization to kind of recharge, I suppose, and find yourself again. That's kind of the promise behind this, right? And that's, I think, where it kind of comes full circle again as a myth, but also in terms of its iconic purchase, is the link to the story itself, where Crusoe kind of finds himself spiritually, religiously on the island because of the isolation, right? That's not necessarily the what the travel company wants to offer. It's selling a product, of course, you know, but I thought that was an interesting link. And just to kind of reinforce that, and I won't talk for much longer, the company has an icon after its name, which, when I saw it, looked to me like the very famous single footprint on the beach that Crusoe encounters, very famous moment. And the footprint itself is iconic, isn't it? You know, it's also completely unrealistic. I mean, there surely should be other footprints somewhere on the beach, but they're not. It's just one single footprint. Crusoe reacts with horror to it after quite a long period of isolation. Right. And of course, I jumped to the conclusion that that stylized icon must be the footprint, also because of what the company was selling in terms of splendid isolation, if you like. And to my great surprise, when I sent a company representative my essay, it was pointed out to me, no, that's a parrot. It's Polly. You know, this just goes to show like how people see different things, how I see different things, even though they're not meant to be that, in terms of how the myth and the icon has been used and how majorly flexible it has become, but also without entirely losing touch in a roundabout way with the original story. Yeah, and I think Ian Watt made that point 70 years ago already.
Right. What made Robinson Crusoe a cultural icon for Western readers? And accordingly, how does the name Robinson Crusoe function as an iconic signifier in our Western collective consciousness?
Well, in those ways, the iconic signifier here is this idea of human survival in a hostile, distant place and what that feels like, right? This kind of thought experiment, you know, right. Kind of revisited over and over again in different formats, whether it's in other stories, you know, Robinsonades or movies or whatever, or computer games, for example, where you can actually, as a first-person player, play this through yourself, right? The psychological aspect of this too, right? What would it feel like to be in the shoes of an isolated man or woman in right. a hostile place where you have to just cope by yourself? And I think there's a fundamental fascination with that kind of scenario and putting yourself in that place. And I think the icon of Robinson Crusoe as a name, as in what it signifies, is kind of encapsulates that thought experiment.
Right. Right. Well, Glynis, this collection you co-edited with Andreas, titled Robinson Crusoe After 300 Years, can be perhaps viewed as a study of the afterlife of the novel Robinson Crusoe, or more precisely, a study of the Robinsonade, right? Could you share a bit more on what these Robinsonades tell us about the literary and the cultural values of the original novel? And subsequently, what can we briefly learn from these Robinsonades that the essays in this collection touch upon?
Yeah, I think the afterlife of Robinson Crusoe is probably due to the fact that a variety of different readers across the centuries have seen the possibility of a huge variety of interpretations of the text. For example, we could read it in the context of Defoe's life and his dissenting faith. Defoe was trained for the dissenting ministry, and Crusoe certainly reflects on his faith while he's on the island, especially when he thinks he's near death. On the other hand, for 19th and early 20th century British readers, probably the aspect of the text that seemed most important to them was a gendered and an imperial message. Crusoe exhibits survival skills and attitudes that were seen at that time suitable role models for boys in the then British Empire. We can't get away from that in this text. We could contrast this 19th century view that Crusoe is a figure to emulate in terms of his survival skills, in terms of his staking a sort of imperial claim to the island, with 20th and 21st century engagement with the text, which recognizes that Crusoe's relationship with the native he calls Friday in a very utilitarian way could be seen as representative of the whole kind of ugly, murderous history of Western imperialism. If we think about the fact that before Crusoe is shipwrecked, he's sold a boy into slavery. He's profited from a South American plantation that uses slave labor. He claims an island as his, essentially, because he has a gun and the local native peoples who visit the island do not. He's quite content for Friday to call him master. He instructs Friday in Christianity.
If you have enjoyed this episode and want to hear the entire episode, you can subscribe at theglobalnovel.com/subscribe. Thank you so much for listening.